untouched by the filth of this world. As an irony, Rax runs his hand along the wall, leaving behind the faintest streak of oil and sweat. There, now the world has left its mark, he thinks. No, he is not of this world, he tells himself. He has transcended it. Palpatine saw that. Yes, the old man was delusional about the mystical forces that governed the galaxy, giving too much credence to them. He believed that just because he had abilities beyond the ken of mortals, all things cleaved to the same power. Which is madness, really. It is the primitive attitude of a creature learning to make fire for the first time, certain that the fire he made was the only power that governed the galaxy. And yet Palpatine wasn't delusional about the state of the galaxy and the role of the Empire. Though he infused it with a great deal of magical foolishness, he was a master tactician and knew how to play a game so long that the horizon line was actually the starting line. Palpatine saw something in Rax. A destiny, he called it. Even now, Galley in a way, for he feels oddly young and innocent again, like that Jakku child running across the desert, feels that destiny swelling up inside him. He takes a moment to enjoy it, to feel filled up by it. Satiety resonates through him. But the job is not done. Not yet. Ahead, the hallway opens up into an eight-sided chamber. In the center of it is a same-shaped bank of computer systems, but not systems like the ones found on a Star Destroyer, or even the Death Star. No, these are ancient computational mechanisms from an earlier civilization. From precisely when, Rax cannot say. The Old Republic? The fallen Sith Empire? He knows not, and he cares little. Their history is irrelevant. It is only the present that matters. Above the computers is the projection of a three-dimensional star chart that matches no known map here in the galaxy. Which makes sense, given that it does not chart the known galaxy, does it? For decades, these computers have been plotting a journey. Outside the known galaxy is an unexplored infinity, Palpatine explained. One closed off by a labyrinth of solar storms, rogue magnetospheres, black holes, gravity wells, and things far stranger. Any who tried to conquer that maze did not survive. The ships were obliterated or returned to the galaxy devoid of travelers. Communications from those explorers were incomprehensible, either shot through with such static as to make the content useless, or filled with enough inane babble to serve as a perfectly clear sign that the explorer had gone utterly mad out there in isolation. But Palpatine had one in the Navy who knew something of the unknown regions. Admiral Thrawn, an alien with ice-blue skin who came from beyond the borders of the known galaxy. Palpatine only kept that one around because of what he knew of traversing those deadly interstices. Much of what Thrawn knew went into the computations of this machine. Palpatine said that this galaxy was to be his, but that it was only one among many. Again, that phrase arose, the unexplored infinity. This, he noted, was his domain. The galaxy was his game board. If he lost this game, the game board was to be broken in half and discarded. A new domain must then be found. The computers here have long been searching for a way through the storms and the black spaces. Slowly, surely, they have been putting together a map, a journey into chaos. The Empire has sent probe droids to test the computations as the computers have made them. Many never returned. But some kept reporting in, pinging the transponder here. Every droid that made it further contributed to the map. And with distance achieved, the computers, through the scanning droids, continued to chart the course and compute the next branches of navigation. Before Palpatine's demise at the hands of the rebels, the computers finished their calculations, finally finding a way through the unknown. The Emperor was convinced that something waited for him out there. Some origin of the Force. Some dark presence formed of malevolent substance. He said he could feel the waves of it radiating out now that the way was clear. The Emperor called it a signal, conveniently one that only he could hear. Even his greatest enforcer, Vader, seemed oblivious to it. And Vader also claimed mastery over the dark force, did he not? Rax believed Palpatine had gone mad. What he was receiving was nothing more than his own precious wishes broadcast back to himself, an echo of his own devising. He believed that something lay beyond, and so that became a singular obsession. When you believe in magic, it is easy to see all the universe as evidence of it. Now that Palpatine is gone, the original purpose of the observatory can be maintained. The game is lost. Time to exit and find a new domain. The Empire is dead. But the Empire can live again under Rax. First, though, preparations must be made. Beyond the map chamber is one more hallway. This one with steps leading down. As Rax passes the computers, he sees on the far side a gift that Palpatine left for him. It is a broken Chatez board. It lies shattered on the floor in halves. All around it are the pieces, also broken. Only two pieces remain, the Imperator and the Outcast. He wonders, is that how Palpatine saw him? As the Outcast? This is new. Gallius never knew that. It hits him like a slap to the face. He wants to struggle against it, to rage against the idea that he was some kind of exile at the margins of the Empire. And yet, he was, wasn't he? Rax always kept a distance. His role was never to preserve the Empire, but to destroy it. He snatches up both pieces. With a juggle of his fingers, he rolls the two figures around in the palm of his hand. Whatever Palpatine thought of him before, he is no longer the Outcast. Rax has become the Imperator. Gallius pockets both pieces and continues on, humming his favorite cantata as he goes. The hallway ahead is lined with artifacts of the old Sith Empire. A red mask, a white lance, a bloody banner. A holocron so black it seems to consume all the light around it. Between each of the artifacts is a smooth-faced sentinel droid, slumbering in its chamber, ready to be woken if a threat approaches. Beyond all that is the well. The well is a channel bored through the schist and mantle of Jakku, drilled so deep it touches the center of the world. The well glows with wisps of blue mist winding up through orange firelight. The light pulses and throbs like a living thing. Palpatine told him that once this world was verdant, overgrown with green and home to oceans. He said that though the surface of the world no longer shows it, the core still has that vital spark of life essence. And he added, "That essence disgusts me." Tashu gambols down in front of the artifacts, his fingertips dancing along their cases. He mutters to himself, and Rax sees that he's chewed his own lips bloody. "Are you ready?" he asks Palpatine's old advisor.
"I am,"
Tashu says, turning. His cheeks are wet with tears, his teeth slick with red.
"Palpatine lives on. we will find him again out there in the dark. Everything has arranged itself as our master foretold. All things move toward the great design. The sacrifices have all been made.
Not all of them, Rax thinks. You must be clothed in the raiment of darkness, Rax says. The mantle of the dark side is yours to wear. At least for a time. At least until we can find Palpatine and revivify him, bringing his soul back to flesh anew. This is all a lie, of course. He believes none of it. It is a ruse sold to Teshu. Lies are like leashes. Tug them just so, and all who believe them will comply. And the lunatic believes it. Because lunatics always believe the things that confirm their view of the galaxy. Teshu's view is that the dark side is all. That Palpatine was the master not just of the Empire, but of everyone and everything. And that through all of this, the Dark Lord will be reborn. Good. Let him believe that. Rax helps him carry the lance and the banner. He carefully puts the mask upon the man's head, tightening it with black leather straps and a buckle of old tarnished chromatite. Teshu owns many masks, all of which he believes contain some fragment of the dark side. But never before has he worn one like this. It is a vicious, bestial thing, with tusks of coiling black steel and eyes of blood-red kyber crystals. As it snaps against his face, Teshu tightens up. A hungry moan, ill-contained behind his clenching jaw. The final piece, Rax says, handing Teshu the holocron. Even as the man takes it, it seems to leech the light from all around. Teshu goes even paler as he touches it. The veins in his hand stand dark in contrast.
Yes,
Teshu says. One word, short, clipped, ecstatic. His arms stretch out by his sides. His hands shake.
Yes, I can feel it. I am a locus of dark energies. All the death and despair of the world is filtering through me. I can feel it on the back of my tongue, captured there like a struggling moth.
Then come, let us pray. Interrupts Teshu, because if he does not, the man will continue to gabble for minutes, hours, perhaps until both of them have died of old age and gone to dust. Gallius Rax leads Teshu the way a parent leads a child by the hand. Together they go to the well. As they approach, a narrow platform extends out, as if sensing their presence. It drifts out over the well. A plank they must walk. They go out together. Out here, the air is somehow both hot and cold. Warm breath interspersed with wisps of ice.
Palpatine will be pleased by you, Rax says.
Yes, he will. And by you too. We've done it. We have punished the undeservers. We have activated the contingency. Let us speak a prayer to the darkness. A prayer to all the things that wait.
First, my brother, I'd like to ask you something.
Yes, little galley.
What will you say to him when you see our master again?
Rax gives him no chance to answer. He pushes Teshu. The man cartwheels through the mist and the light, spinning, screaming. His body hits the side and slams against the rock, silencing his cries. The body goes and goes until Rax cannot see it anymore. A few beats of quiet and stillness. One, two, three.
The world shudders. A fierce growl grumbles up through the bore, and the orange light glows suddenly red. the blue threads of mist turn black.
Palpatine was right. The artifacts contain a great deal of energy. And now they have dropped into the core of this world. With the well open, that energy will vent. So begins the chain reaction that will destroy everything. The planet will soon begin to crack. It shall break apart. It'll swallow the Empire and the New Republic fleets and soldiers whole. When it does, it will leave this galaxy to the scavengers and the scum, rotting like a fruit lying forgotten in the dirt. Though an idle thought troubles him. All fruit, no matter how rotten, can leave behind seeds. It's time to leave. The Imperialis awaits. His destiny calls like a seductive whisper. But then he realizes he's hearing voices. Real voices. He is not alone in here. Not anymore. And one of those voices he recognizes.
Hello, Sloane,
he thinks. The ground shudders suddenly beneath them. Moving hard to the right, Nora nearly loses her footing. Brenton helps to steady her, and she pulls out of his grip, casting him a suspicious look. You don't trust me, he says.
I don't,
she says under her breath.
I don't know what's in your head. I don't know if the chip is still controlling you. I don't know why you were with her, of all people.
He's about to say more, but Sloane interrupts.
Look!
Sloane says, pointing to a bank of octagonal computers. Above them, hollow screens flash red. A diagram shows what looks like a mining bore down through layers of mantle and schist. It's pulsing white. A number sits above it. A percentage. Slowly dwindling.
What am I seeing?
Nora asks.
I don't know, Sloane answers.
Brenton hurries over to the machine, looking down at a keyboard with a quizzical glance. The keys are triangular, most gold, some silver. He ignores those and instead moves his hand to the holoscreen itself. And when his fingers touch it, it swipes away and fills with scrolling data.
Oh no.
What is it?
Nora and Sloane say in unison before giving each other a dirty, dubious look.
The integrity of the planet has been compromised. Something is affecting the mantle. A system of tremors causing a cascading failure from the core up. This shaft, this borehole, it's the key to it. A channel focusing the seismic wave. There are baffles here, telescoping vents to close the shaft, but they're on lockdown.
What does all that mean?
Sloane asks.
It means this world doesn't have long.
Nora's knees nearly buckle. Temin, he's here. Jazz, too. Wedge. The whole damn Republic fleet. If Jakku goes, they all go. Can you close it?
Nora asks.
I can try.
Do that! Sloane barks. I'm finding Rax. He has to be here somewhere.
Her voice sounds threadbare and desperate. Nora points her blaster at the other woman.
No.
Sloane stares down the barrel of the pistol.
I'm not the enemy here. You're my enemy. You corrupted my husband. You brought him on this lunatic's journey. What I am is running out of time. Rax is the one behind all of this. Put that pistol down, Nora Wexley. Let me do what I need to do.
Brenton now comes up behind Nora, and she flinches, fearing he's there to attack her. But all he does is say,
Please, Nora.
Her hand shakes so hard she's afraid it might fall off. Nora lowers the pistol.
Go. You could give me the pistol. Only way I give you this pistol is by pulling the trigger first. Fair enough. I don't need a blaster anyway. I am weapon enough.
Sloane nods, as if summoning enough courage to make her last statement true. Then she turns on her heel and walks away, heading down an adjacent hallway.
Not once does she look back over her shoulder. Nora wheels on her husband and hisses at him. You need to fix this! Brenton, listen very closely. Temin is here on Jakku. Your son! If you love him, and you love me, and you care at all about the New Republic that you once fought to build, fix this!
Fear and uncertainty flash like lightning in Brenton's eyes. But he nods, and in a quiet, firm voice he says,
I will.
She finds him waiting for her. Down a set of steps, past a wall lined with what looked to be powered-down droids, Rax waits. An infernal glow rises behind him, with blue embers whirling in the air above.
Hello, Rax,
Sloan says. It's just her in here with him. She has nothing. No weapon. That damnable Nora Wexley wouldn't lend her a blaster. That awful woman was stubborn as the roots of an old tree. Smart move, admittedly. Sloan thought to simply take it from the woman, but in no world does she believe Brenton Wexley would allow that. And so she tells herself what she told them.
I am weapon enough.
At the very least, she knows they won't be leaving her behind. The shuttle gave up the ghost moments before landing. It was already shot to hell when they took it from the Imperial base, and as the ship settled toward the ground, coming in to land through the blowing sand and whipping dust, the engines gave out. The repulsors failed, and the whole ship thudded dully as it dropped. The panel went dark. The ship died.
There goes our ride, she thought.
Good news was, they didn't have to use the shuttle to blast the doors open. The door wasn't locked. She stepped to it, and it opened. No turbo lasers, no defenses at all. An unlocked door. Worry seized her. Was Rax even here? Were they too late? Now she knows. He's here. This ends. Rax looks unarmed as well. She sees no holster at his hip. Only him standing there. Shoulders back. Chest puffed out in his white naval uniform. A red cape sweeping behind him.
My, he looks pleased with himself, she thinks.
A smug twist to his lips adds further demonstration. She thinks to punch that smug look right off his face.
Did you see the show?
Rax asks her.
I did, she answers. Was it all for me?
No. The whole galaxy was my audience.
But you...
He kisses the air.
You know more than most. Which means you understood it better than almost anybody else.
I don't understand any of it. So why don't you explain it to me?
She holds up both her hands and gives a little shrug.
You're so proud of what you did here. Tell me, what was this all about, Counselor? Or should I call you Galley? Precious little orphan.
That stings him. He tries not to show it, but his lip twitches. His brow flinches. Her barb lands.
I don't have time for this. I'm leaving.
Her hands form fists.
Only way out is through me.
So be it.
Rax walks toward her. Slow determination seems to urge him forward. The same determination of a predator stalking its prey. Sure-footed, but with an easy, affable gait. Almost as if to say,
Don't worry your little whiskers about me. I won't hurt you, little creature. I will say this,
Rax comments as he takes one deliberate step after the next.
You were so close to it. We were so close. I always thought you'd be with me here at the end. And here you are.
His face goes sour.
Just not how I pictured it.
You still thought I'd work with you? After Akiva? After Chandrilla? You threw me into the fire again and again.
Fire forges some blades.
He makes a dismissive gesture with his hands, like someone throwing away a bit of garbage.
And it ruins others.
He's dead ahead of her now, Rax stops walking. He smiles.
I'm not letting you leave here alive,
she says.
How does this work, then? I don't have a blaster.
He tugs back the curtain of his cape to show the void of weapons at either side.
I suppose I should have brought one.
You should have two.
If wishes were starships,
he finishes the refrain,
then farmers would fly.
Sloane pitches forward into the breach, moving fast. Everything has been coming to this moment, and she's like a compressed spring, coming unsprung. Like she's been saving up all that hatred and all that rage, tamping it down deep, so deep that it's ready to burst out like a scalding geyser. The rage and the hate end at the front of her fist. Rax isn't a boxer. He hasn't had to fight his own fight since forever. Maybe since never. He doesn't see the hit coming. The fist clubs him in the nose. It gives way with a pop. He goes down, and she drops atop him, snarling. At the computer, Brenton's fingers move hesitantly over the keys. He hits one button, and the holoscreen flashes angrily, a pulse of red light filling the room. Brenton curses and closes his eyes, refocusing. The ground quakes again, sending her heart into her throat. Nora sees the percentage dwindling. Now it's down to 47.
We should have given her the blaster, Brenton says suddenly.
What?
Sloane. She's alone and unarmed.
Nora bares her teeth at him, then gestures at him with the weapon.
Brenton, I don't even know which part is you and which part is the chip in your head. Until we get it out, I'll never know. Just turn this thing off.
I'm sorry, he says, staring down at the keys,
his fingers moving frantically.
I'm so sorry for everything.
Now isn't the time.
Now might be the only time, Nora. I want you to know, the man who did those things on Chandrilla, it wasn't me.
I know. But I also don't know which man you are now.
I'm me. It's not the chip.
So why are you with her?
Nora seethes.
She's the enemy, Brenton. The one you promised to fight against with tooth and claw when you joined the rebellion. And now here you are, traveling with her. Maybe that chip in your head scrambled your brain, but she's not your wife.
She isn't with the Empire anymore.
Oh, that's comforting. I'm sure that erases everything she's done.
It doesn't. I know it doesn't. But
her husband utters a wordless moan that devolves into a frustrated growl. The screen suddenly flashes red again, and he squeezes both of his hands into fists.
Ugh, I don't know how to explain it. I don't, okay? All I know is even if I wasn't in control of myself, I did a bad thing and I want to fix it. Sloane wanted the same thing, I think. And we found ourselves together here with common purpose.
Together. That's great.
Not like that,
he pleads.
Please. I love you. I'm here for you. And for Tem. I wanted to do something right to counteract the wrong I'd done.
Being on Jakku, it felt good. It felt like justice. What do you want to do, Brenton? Go in after her?
She needs our help. She's not as bad as you think she is.
And she's still not any good.
There's a greater evil in there.
Then let her fight it by herself.
Anger and hatred are blinding. Sloane realizes that too late. When she unleashed them, it was like a white flash. It was satisfying and warm.
But it blinded her.
Rax took the hit and went down, but it was way too easy. Soon as she's on top of him, she sees that glint in his eyes, clever and wary. And she knows she's just been lured into making yet another mistake. His fist pistons into her side, right where the ribs never healed, right where Nora shot her back on Chandrilla. And the fist, it doesn't hit like a set of hard knuckles. It has a peak to it, a sharpness.
Pain hits her there like a lightning strike, and she howls. Her eyes are closed for half a second. And then, her head rocks backward as he lurches upward, slamming his forehead into her lower jaw. Bam! Her teeth dig into her lip. Blood fills her mouth, and she falls off him. Stars dance, and light smears across her vision. She gags on her own fluids as she crab walks backward, anguish washing over her like a tide of acid. Rax is back on his feet and marching toward her. Sloane tries to stand, but he drives the nose of his boot into her side. The same side. Something gives way. A bone, a rib. She cries out and slumps. He has something in his hand. Rax gives it a little twirl. A carving of some kind. A hooded figure. He moves it back to the palm of his hand, letting the top of it poke through the gap between his knuckles. Playfully, he stabs at the air with that fist. Swish! And now she knows what hurt so bad when he hit her. A piece from a Chatez board, Rax says, his words dripping with satisfaction. He's like someone preening in the mirror. Hurts, I wager. I saw you favoring that side back at the base, by the way. Seems my instincts were right to hit you there. His haughty smile is suddenly empty of mirth and falls slack on his face. I really am disappointed it ended this way. You should have been with me now. As an ally. Something crosses his face that looks like an epiphany. You were an outcast too, in a way, weren't you? Held at arm's length by an empire that did not want to know you. The ground rumbles. A crack suddenly splits the floor.
What is happening?
She asks.
The end of all things,
Rax says with a theatrical pout. She kicks out with a foot, hoping to surprise him and catch him in the knee. He's close now, tantalizingly so. And if she can drop him... Rax catches her foot and swings her sideways with surprising strength. Her body crashes into one of the pillars. More pain radiates through her in concentric ripples. You think I can't fight? He says with a hook-lipped sneer. His eyes are alive with a mania she has never seen in him before. As you said, I was an orphan on this world. I was a child when I killed my first man. A scavenger who came upon this place and thought he'd found a treasure. I crushed his throat with my bare hands. I killed men, beasts, other children. You boxed to win trophies. I fought to save my life and serve my emperor. Through a bubble of spit and blood, she says,
I don't serve the emperor. I serve the empire.
Your empire is gone. I have killed it. He tilts his head as if he's listening for something. You have friends. You aren't alone. Let's call them to us, shall we? He drops on top of her, grabbing for her left hand. She struggles to pry it away, but he presses down with his knee, pushing her shoulder to the floor. He grips her smallest finger on that hand, and... snap! He levers it backward until it quickly breaks. Sloane screams!
Yes, cry out. The bleat of an animal summoning its pack.
He grabs the next finger in. Again! He breaks that one next.
He hums a song, one swallowed by her pair of screams. Only later will she recognize it for what it is. The cantata of Cora Vesora.
Sloane's scream reaches their ears. The percentage on the hollow screen is down to 33. The walls have begun to split. The floor, too. The tremors do not come erratically. Now they are constant. A low-grade rumbling as dust streams down around them. The war is ongoing inside Nora's heart. Rebels versus Imperials. Freedom versus oppression. But it's more complicated than that.
Now there's a war between her and her own husband. Who is he? What has he become? Can they ever be the same again? And then there's the battle over Sloane. Nora wants to leave that woman to her business. Let her win or let her die. Whatever is going on beyond that door is not her business, she tells herself. Let them scrap it out, and whoever emerges will either find themselves dragged before a New Republic tribunal or meet her blaster. Even that is a war of grave indecision. Again, the confrontation of the old dichotomy. Justice versus revenge. Justice is of the mind. Revenge is of the heart. Which wins out? Which deserves to win? Sloane has seized upon revenge. Nora saw that in her. If she lets her be in there alone, isn't she doing the same? Doesn't that make her no different from Sloane? Then, a second scream, alive with pain. Blast it all to hell. She turns away from the computer and raises the pistol. Brenton asks, "What are you doing?" "I don't know," she responds. It's an honest answer.
"You're helping Sloane."
"Maybe. No. I don't know. You stay here."
"I'm getting somewhere. I've closed one of the baffles. I just need to slice through the defenses to get the others."
"Hurry!"
Nora marches off toward the sound of Sloane's cries. Ahead is a long hallway. It descends at an easy angle. Red lights around black metal cast everything in a diabolical glow. Pillars line the side like dark, gleaming guards. Beyond, in the walls, she spies the empty, implacable faces of droids sealed into the walls. It reminds her of the prison ship on Kashyyyk, and she fails to repress a shudder. Where does this passage go? What awaits at the end? No sign of anything or anyone here. It's eerily quiet. She's about to yell for Sloane, but then she sees her. The woman is alone on the floor, unconscious, her hair splayed out around her like a spreading puddle. Behind her is a massive pit from which emits a hellish glow. The borehole, she thinks. Sloane lifts her head, casting a bleary eye to her.
"Run,"
Sloane says, her voice mushy. The warning comes a moment too late. Someone steps out from behind one of the pillars. Nora cries out, raising her blaster, but the heel of the man's hand catches her right under the chin, driving up under Nora's jaw so hard her whole head rattles. The dark behind her eyes explodes with light, and the man's other hand catches her blaster, twisting it out of her grip handily. So handily, in fact, that she's shamed by how easily she lost her one and only weapon. She cries out and tries to flee, but the blaster cracks her in the head, and as she staggers forward onto her hands and knees, she looks over her shoulder to see him raise the weapon. This man in naval whites. This man in his red cape. Gallius Rax. The architect behind everything, if Sloane is to be believed. Then his gaze flits beyond her. The sound of running footsteps echoes.
"Brenton!"
Her husband leaps, slamming into Rax hard. The blaster goes off, but the shot goes wide, smacking into the ceiling above her head. Brenton gets underneath the blaster, wrenching it upward. The two men struggle. It all seems to happen in slow motion. Nora works to stand, dizzied by the blow. But she moves, has to move, even though it feels like her brain isn't connected to anything, like her feet are stuck in mud. She throws her body against the wall behind Rax, and she reaches for him, even as he kicks out with a boot, knocking Brenton back. Even as Rax raises the blaster, even as she hears herself screaming, even as her hands close on his throat from behind, as the blaster goes off, as Brenton staggers back, as a black, burning hole blooms in the center of her husband's chest, like a dark flower opening to the sun.
Brendan falls backward, clutching at his breastbone.
Rax spins around to meet Nora face to face. His visage is rictus of raw, blistering rage. It is the fury of a fiend trapped in the corner and desperate to claw its way free. He pumps a knee into her stomach.
She doubles over, but urges herself forward, slamming him into the wall. The pistol swings and cracks her across the cheek, and she feels something there give way. A disc in her neck slipping as misery radiates in every direction across her body. She wants to stop. She wants to roll over and give up and plead. Let me have a moment with my husband. Just one before you kill me.
But that mote of desperation is swallowed in a wave of rage all her own. Nora roars as she grabs the man behind the leg and yanks out. He slams backward, and the two of them fall. The blaster is between them, all hands on it. They struggle. He wrenches her sideways. Her head crashes into the wall, concussed.
Her vision starts to slip like a broken gear. In her blurred vision, she sees Brendan there by the wall, holding his chest, staring up at her. His mouth forms words that she can't hear, but she can see.
I love you.
I love you too, she says,
the words garbled and messy.
She cries out as she summons every molecule of strength she can muster, turning the blaster centimeter by dreadful centimeter toward Rax's chest. Her finger finds the trigger.
His head slams hard into hers. The blaster goes off.
Rax cries out and throws her off him. He pulls himself up as the whole place shakes and shudders and bangs. The man clutches at his shoulder, blood staining his whites. You shot me, he says, incredulous.
Nora, whimpering, pulls herself toward her husband.
His name slips from her lips in a babbled mantra. Brendan, Brendan, Brendan.
And she crawls over to him and cradles his head,
telling him that he'll be okay, that she'll get him help, that she survived death so many times, she knows he can survive too.
But his eyes are dead as coins, and his mouth is slack.
Nora cries out. She cradles him. She crumples against him. I just want to sleep. I just want to be with him again. I'm so sorry, Brendan. So sorry I didn't believe you. So sorry I...
Rax stumbles away from her, down the hall, holding his injured shoulder. Nora watches him escape through blurry vision.
No! Come back. I'm not done with you yet.
She drags herself off Brendan, crawling like a common cur toward her retreating foe. It's then that her hand bumps into something. The blaster. He doesn't have it. She does. Gritting her teeth together so hard she fears they might grind down to powder, she raises the pistol from her position on the floor. Her hand dips and swerves. Her vision smears. Everything is made worse by the shaking. The ground buckles underneath her. Then a shape moves past her. It's Sloane. The other woman is up on her feet, pursuing Rax now. Through Nora's double, now triple vision, she watches the two Imperials clash once more, each clumsily brutalizing the other with fists and kicks. Nora points the pistol at one, then the other, then feels her hand weakening. She doesn't even know if she has the strength to pull the trigger. Sloane cries out, thrown against the wall, as Rax uses the wall to pull himself up the steps. She speaks a word, a name. Sloane! The woman turns toward her.
Nora,
with the last measure of her strength, spins the blaster across the floor toward the other woman. And unconsciousness takes her away like a swift river.
Chapter 36. Security speeders hover in the space around the Senate Tower. Strobing lights throb against the white. Down below, a crowd is gathered, and Singier steps into it, pushing past, driven by the dueling forces of grief and anger. He doesn't even know what he's looking for, or what he hopes to accomplish. Once security forces came and took away Tolwar Wartol, Singier had to come here and see it for himself. Perhaps for a vigil. Perhaps as a detective. Perhaps simply as a witness to it all. It reminds him again of Endor. After it had all happened, with the battle ending and his comrades strewn about, bloodied and defeated, he felt the same sense of dislocation. Like he was no longer connected to anything. A man untethered. To Kask Walask Tidan. Man without a star. But now he has a star. Or had, until this. Ahead, he finds someone joining him.
Leia,
he says. She cradles her stomach, but it doesn't slow her down.
I should have known they'd make a second attempt on her. They hate her. I should have seen it. How she was at the center of it all.
To the crowd, Leia barks.
Move! Move out of my way!
A murmur of awe in her wake. Ahead, through the crowd, Singier sees something impossible. A specter, surely. A wraith, summoned by his own guilt. He sees her for only a moment. When the security forces around her part, Chancellor Mon Mothma, shrugging a blanket off her shoulders, denying its comfort.
No, it can't be, can it?
The crowd closes around her again, and Singier can't see. He thinks to get ahead of Leia to help her part the crowd, but the princess is doing a fine enough job of that on her own. The volume of her voice rising to express her natural gift of command. As everyone moves aside, Singier leaps into Leia's wake to follow her. A guard steps in front of him, separating Singier from the princess, a sparking baton thrusting toward him. Leia reaches back and twists it from the man's grip. The baton clatters. Two guards move into the fray when...
Stop!
Her voice. One word. Tolling like a bell. Clear and crisp. The Chancellor steps forward, easing herself between the security peace officer and Singier.
He is my advisor,
she says coolly.
Chancellor, I...
Singier gasps.
You're alive. I am.
Her face is a stern, grim mask. Leia gasps.
Mon!
And the two of them melt together in a crushing hug.
Leia's head falls to the Chancellor's shoulder, and Mon lifts her head back, eyes closed, seeming to savor the moment.
When they pull away from each other, Singier asks,
But how? That blast? I wasn't in it. I wasn't here.
She must see the confusion on his face, so she answers it.
You made me feel guilty for not buying my own baby gift for a dear friend. Remember?
With that, she gives a knowing look to Leia.
I went out on my own. I left Oxy in my place.
That last sentence is a struggle for her to get out. Sadness crosses her face like the shadow from a passing cloud.
Oxy? Leia asks. Is she?
She nods.
Oxy is gone.
Mon says,
That leaves you as my only advisor, Singier. And your counsel is needed swiftly.
To Leia.
Yours as well, my friend.
Singier assures her.
We will find whoever did this, starting now.
No, not that. Something else. What could possibly be more important?
She clasps his hands and holds them tight.
Mos Amida has come out of hiding and wants to sign a ceasefire. He wants to end it. All of it. The Empire is surrendering.
And I need the both of you.
Chapter 37. The ground is shaking now, hard enough that Ray Sloan is sure the observatory is going to collapse into the ground, a consumptive fissure swallowing them all. Sloan isn't sure she can do anything about it, but she has to try. She's here, trapped on this world, and what else can be done but try to save it? Woozy, bloodied, and beaten, she follows Rax up the steps, blaster in hand. He looks over his shoulder, a craven fear crossing his face as the mask of confidence falls away.
Get away!
He seethes, batting at the air with a bloody hand. Sloan shoots him in the back of his right leg. Gallius Rax. Gally bugles in pain and falls against the steps. With a groan, he pushes himself up on both hands. She shoots him in the other shoulder. He slumps, sobbing. Then as he turns over, his hands up in surrender as he pleads,
Don't, please!
She shoots him in the stomach. Every shot feels perfect. Every shot feels like revenge. Sloane's heard stories about revenge. About how it never really finishes everything. About how it never truly completes you. But at this moment, she disbelieves. Because this feels better than anything has ever felt to her. Rax's hands move to his midriff, where a spreading red stains his raiment. Soon his navel white matches the red cape spilled beneath him. Unblinking, he stares at her, mouth gasping. Something wet slides in the back of his throat, like a creeping thing. "You're dying," she tells him. And he is. That much is plain to see. His lips have gone chapped and pale.
"Fellow outcast," he says.
"Yes."
"You serve the contingency now."
"I serve no one," she says.
"Listen! Listen! There's a ship, a short walk from here,"
he wheezes.
"Imperialis! Take it! Hux is there. Others! Use the map in a data spike, in the computer. Set a course for the unexplored."
He coughs. Flecks of red dot his lips, along with bubbles of spit.
"Infinity already sent a ship ahead. A dreadnought. The Emperor's."
It hits her. Of course. Back on Coruscant, looking through the Imperial archives and taking an accounting of all the ships, one stood out as not being accounted for properly. It was said the New Republic took it down, but no tracking record showed that fate. "The Eclipse," she says. He nods.
"Go to it. Leave this place. Find a new domain. Start the game over."
His teeth clench together with a vice grip. Through them, he keeps talking, babbling now.
"Undeserving. I am undeserving. Just a skittermouse, not of a walker. Outcast. Always the outcast. Shates. Corvisora. Undeserved."
His head thuds against the step. A line of blood oozes from his nose as the last flash of light goes dark behind his eyes. Sloan stands. From his hand, she takes something else. The pair of game pieces. Imperator and Outcast.
"Mine," she thinks.
The vibration underneath her wakes her. Nora groans, picking herself up. Her husband is beneath her, eyes shut, as if sleeping. She pretends that's what it is. "He's just asleep. I'll wake him later, when
when it's time to go.
She grabs the wall and pulls herself up. Moving toward the steps, she sees another body there. It's him, Gallius Rax. His red cape pools beneath him like spilled viscera. For him, she tells a different story.
He's not asleep. He is dead. Revenge has won the day. Justice has fled into the shadows.
Nearby, a sound. Fingers on keys. The ground suddenly shifts hard, and she almost loses her footing. Nora continues up the stairs, one agonizing step at a time. Her gaze follows the sound, the tapping sound, and ahead stands a figure. A bit blurry, but when she blinks, the gauzy smear of her vision clarifies. It's Sloane. The blaster pistol is on the floor between them. Nora staggers to it and picks it up.
Sloane,
she says, pointing the blaster. The Imperial, or not, who knows where her loyalties lie anymore, turns toward her, hands by her side. Behind her, the computers project an image of a mechanism. Locks and chain drive banding and telescoping doors. Those are the baffles Brenton was trying to close. But he didn't. He stopped to save her.
No, he stopped to die. Nora Wexley,
Sloane says.
You and me, once again, at the end of things. Yes.
It's all she can say. What else is there? Is any of this even real? Is it all a fever dream? Or is she still lying there on the floor with her husband, asleep, dying or already dead?
Brenton, is he...
He's fine, Nora protests. The words so firm and so fierce, they serve as a kind of sharp-tongued protest. But she knows he's not. Tears streak down her cheeks, and she has to lift her chin to try to deny them.
He's gone,
she says finally, admitting the truth out loud.
I'm sorry. He was a better traveling companion than I deserved. Yes, that's true.
Nora swallows hard.
What are we going to do here? I don't know yet. I need to finish what Brenton started and stop this planet from destroying itself. Something has happened in the core, but I can end it. Best I can tell, there are mechanisms that can close the borehole, that can seal off the reaction from heating the mantle and cracking this planet like a geode. Oh, you should let me do that, just in case you should go. I don't know where. Find your son. Go home. Have a life. Easier said than done. Easier for you than it will be for me. I have none of those things. I never had a husband or a wife to die in my hands. I never had a child. I had only the Empire. And now...
Nora doesn't need her to say any more.
I'm sad for you,
Nora says. And she's surprised that she means it.
I am too.
Are you going to kill me?
Brenton said you weren't as bad as I thought you were.
Sloane shrugs.
Damned with faint praise yet again, it seems. Aren't we all? Damned, I mean. Maybe. Maybe not. You go ahead. Save the world. I'm going to leave now,
Nora says, sighing and wiping tears away. The blaster clatters from her hand.
Let's hope Brenton is right, and you aren't as bad as I think.
Sloane gives her a small nod.
Good luck, Nora Wexley. You too, Grand Admiral Sloane.
Nora turns and goes back down the steps to claim her husband. Outside, the air is red, choked with dust. Nora tucks her chin and mouth under the collar of her shirt, affording her some small reprieve.
Brenton is heavy, but a burden she feels necessary to bear. She intends to take him back to Akiva.
Back to where she can bury a body in the salt marshes, as is the way of her people. Back to the world where he's not just a memory,
where he can be a face that her son can touch, a body over which Temin can grieve.
But where?